This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for June 3rd, 2013. It was a short week, only 4 days, and we picked up 7 items that we thought would appeal to your varied interests. Everything from a foreign company stock distribution to an innocent spouse equitable relief item. Let's review the headlines as we usually do. First, we have an internal legal memorandum describing the treatment of a target company's distribution of foreign company stock as an indirect disposition of intangible property as part of a fairly complex reorganization. Second, a letter ruling that a settlement agreement will not result in self-dealing where all the parties are properly represented. And then our third item, the IRS addresses granting relief for single rental real estate activity treatment, something that's going to really be important to get our Section 1411 compliance squared away so that we don't pay unnecessary Medicare tax. Our fourth item is a new draft form for reporting specified foreign financial assets that will be used for 2013. The form is up from 2 pages to 3 pages, and it has not become any simpler. Our fifth item is just briefly report to you that the Supreme Court has denied a hearing in the appeal of the taxpayer from the Third Circuit decision in Historic Boardwalk denying historic rehab credits to Pitney Bowes because they were not really partners in a partnership with the Sports Authority of New Jersey. Erica Alvarado is granted equitable innocent spouse relief, and the court here, the tax court summary opinion, the court simply keeps score. They go to the relevant revenue procedure, the 8 factors, consider each of the 8 factors. Erica won 3, her husband won 2, 3 were neutral, and so she wins the day. And finally, a very interesting field attorney advisory concluding that a partnership which went through a significant reorganization and for all practical purposes disappeared into two upstream mergers was still a partnership, had not in fact terminated because the original partners owned the new entity that owned the original partnership and continued to operate it as a single member entity. It's a fascinating lineup. So let's get started. Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-21-018 deals with a Section 361C distribution. A corporation, we'll call it Target, was acquired by a U.S. company, underwent an outbound reorganization after that acquisition, and the U.S. company that acquired it was the parent of a consolidated group. The Target company was converted to a foreign company, and in that conversion, was deemed to have transferred its assets. Now, the company was acquired by a U.S. corporation, converted to a foreign corporation, but still a member of this consolidated group, and the effect of that was a disposition. Code Section 367D2A, two little I, two capital I, the so-called disposition rule, makes it very clear that the Target has to recognize gain on the transfer of intangible property. Whether it is a direct or indirect disposition doesn't matter. The U.S. transferor is treated as receiving the amount that would have been received upon the disposition of the property. That's the disposition rule amount. And, of course, if they have any basis, they get to deduct the basis. Otherwise, they're going to recognize ordinary income. The IRS notes in the internal legal memorandum that a distribution constitutes a disposition without regard to whether gain or loss is recognized on the distribution and without regard to whether the distributee is related to the distributor. So the plain language of Code Section 367, along with the legislative history, make very clear that the disposition rule requires the target company in this circumstance take the disposition rule amount into account at the time of distribution. Item number 2, Letter Ruling 2013-21-027, deals with a settlement agreement and whether or not the parties entering into the settlement agreement had engaged in self-dealing. Let's briefly review fairly complex facts. D is a limited partnership. A, B, and C all own interests in this limited partnership, with C owning the general partnership interest. B, and E is a private foundation. The executors of C's estate are also the co-trustees of the private foundation. So now you got the picture. Prior to C's death, A, B, and C executed an agreement that granted A and B each the right upon C's death to purchase one half of whatever C owned in D. Unfortunately, C's will, when it was submitted to probate, bequeathed his entire general partnership interest in the partnership D to the private foundation E. So now A and B are going to have to negotiate with the private foundation. So you got the executors of the estate, who are also the co-trustees of the private foundation. And they're worried about Code Section 4941. If they violate 4941 and they get engaged in self-dealing, they're going to get hit in the pocketbook. So there was significant litigation, arbitration, court proceedings. Finally, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General of the state in which this litigation was being conducted got involved, was able to help the parties resolve their disputes. They settled everything. So can that involve self-dealing? Let me read what the IRS wrote in this ruling, because they said it better than I could. Although the parties to the settlement agreement could have awaited the end of those proceedings, doing so may have taken many more years, cost a considerable amount in legal fees, and ultimately resulted in less property for E, the private foundation. Instead, the parties chose to settle the dispute. Now here's where we get protection from self-dealing. All parties to the settlement agreement were represented by independent counsel. There is no suggestion of collusion to benefit any particular party. The Attorney General of the state participated in facilitating the settlement agreement. So there's one set of outside eyes. The court with appropriate jurisdiction approved the settlement agreement. So there's another set of outside eyes. Self-dealing is unlikely to happen with all that sunlight, right? So the IRS rules that this agreement did not constitute self-dealing. So the trustees and who are also the executors do not have to worry about Code Section 4941. Next, an electronic communication, a simple one-paragraph email coming out of the chief counsel's office, but it's really important because a lot of our clients have still not awakened to the fact that they did not make a good election to aggregate all of their rental properties. If they did not do that, then each rental property is a separate rental property, and even though your client may be a real estate professional, it's going to be really difficult to get the rental income from those rental properties to be treated as anything other than passive income, and if it's passive income, it's going to be subject to the Medicare tax. So Revenue Procedure 2011-34 offers a safe harbor for the client who intended to make the election to aggregate all rental properties and treat them as a single activity but did not do so. There is a four-point list that must be satisfied to access the safe harbor. Number one, the taxpayer must have failed to make a timely election. Number two, the taxpayer must have filed all the intervening returns as though the election were made. Number three, each of those returns must have been timely filed. And number four, most importantly, there must be reasonable cause. Fortunately, the IRS accepts reasonable cause as I relied on a preparer who didn't know what he or she was doing. I now have a new preparer, and that's the formula. In any event, this reminder that we do have the safe harbor in Revenue Procedure 2011-34, even though the client may not have made the election to treat all the rental activities all the rental properties as a single activity, you can still do so late if you meet all of those requirements. And particularly, this email dealt with appeals. You could even be before appeals. And if appeals has the authority to accept an amended return for any other reason, then they have the authority to accept the amended return and allow you to make the late election. Next, a new Form 8938. 3 pages up from 2. 6 parts up from 4. Part 1 is now a summary of foreign accounts, and Part 5 gives the detail for each account. Part 5 is on page 3. It is possible that some of your clients will have one page 1, one page 2, and a number of pages 3, because page 3 contains Part 5, which is the detail of foreign accounts, and it also contains Part 6, which is the detail of other foreign financial assets. So the new Form 8938, but your page 1 and 2 contain the summaries, and your detail is on page 3, which gives you an opportunity. If you have more than one foreign account or more than one other foreign financial asset, then you're going to have more than one page 3 on your 2013 Form 8938. Next, the Supreme Court's denial of cert in Historic Boardwalk. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a favorable decision, at least favorable to Pitney Bowes by the tax court. We've talked about it in these programs as we went along. Pitney Bowes intended to be a partner in a partnership with the New Jersey Sports Authority. And the reason they were going to be a partner is they were going to get the historic rehab credit. So they put in a calculated amount of money in order to get a calculated amount of historic rehab credit. It was purely an investment. Pitney Bowes never intended to be a partner. They had no meaningful upside potential, no downside risk, and that meant they were not a partner. If Pitney Bowes was not a partner, then this purported partnership only had one owner, one member, and it could not be a partnership. Interesting, one of the, Monty Jekyll, who writes a commentary all the time for tax analysts, commented on this item, and he's very rarely wrong, but this time he completely missed the boat. He wrote for half a page about how this really was a partnership because it had two or more persons banded together to operate this partnership. What he missed was you have to have two or more persons who joined together for the purpose of conducting a trade or business or an investment activity and sharing in the profits and losses therefrom. If Pitney Bowes could not possibly share in any profits or losses, then you didn't have a partnership. That's not hard to get to. What's happened is the entire historic rehab credit marketing apparatus has shut down. There are probably thousands of deals across the country that are waiting for the IRS to produce some sort of safe harbor. The future of tax credit partnerships in general is at risk. I never thought much of them anyway, myself. I didn't quite understand why a taxpayer could buy a tax credit at a discount by simply going through the motions of becoming a partner in a partnership. So what I expect is going to happen is that the IRS will write safe harbor rules requiring that for a partner to receive an allocation of historic rehab credit, the partner must own a certain minimal interest in the partnership. The partner must be a partner for a certain period of time so that we have some reality to the concept of partner and partnership. Next, we have Erica Alvarado, a tax court summary opinion in which Ms. Alvarado was relieved of liability on the basis of equitable relief for an innocent spouse. When Erica divorced Mr. Alvarado, he needed money to restart his life, but the only money he had was in his retirement plan. So she signed the papers that let him take money out of his retirement plan. Therefore, she knew that he had taken money out of his retirement plan, but and then he didn't pay the tax on it. He didn't report it in their joint return, or he reported it in the joint return and didn't pay the tax. In any event, she's now before the tax court. The IRS has turned down her plea for innocent spouse relief on equitable grounds, and she is arguing that she meets more of the 8 factors under Revenue Procedure 2003-61 than her husband. And she's right, according to the tax court. What the court does is articulate those 8 factors and one by one tick them off in her favor or not. First of all, in Revenue Procedure 2003-61, the 8 non-exclusive factors that the commissioners permitted to weigh in making a determination related to equitable relief are marital status, and she wins that one because she's divorced. Economic hardship, she loses that one because there's no economic hardship. Knowledge, she loses that one because she knew. The non-requesting spouse's legal obligation, that's neutral. Significant benefit, she got no benefit, she got no part of the money. Compliance with the income tax law, so she win that one. Compliance with the income tax law, she filed all of her returns on time, so she win that one. There was no discussion of abuse or mental or physical health. So you've got -2, +3, that's a net +1, and Erica wins. So the court simply counted the 8 factors, 8 safe harbor factors in the revenue procedure, and by their scorekeeping, Erica qualified for innocent spouse relief, for equitable innocent spouse relief. Finally, in Field Attorney Advisory 2013-2101F, we have an entity which is ruled to be a continuation of a partnership, even though there is a confusing series of transactions in which partnership interests are exchanged for interests in an entity, and the partnership becomes a disregarded entity that is owned by that entity. So I guess to kind of get a picture here, we've got partners in a LLC, for example, excuse me, and they contribute all of their interests in LLC number one to LLC number two. LLC number two continues to own and operate LLC number one. So the old partners in LLC number one are now partners or members of LLC number two. And the question is, did the partnership terminate? And the answer is no, it did not. And how do we get there? Well, we get there by taking a look at Code Section 708B, which is where the rules for partnership termination are. And the first question is, did any part of the business of the partnership survive? Because if it did, then there's no termination under 708B1A. And of course, the partnership business did continue. The second question is, did you have a 50% or more transfer of either capital or profits in a 12-month period? And since the Treasury Regulation 1.708-1B2 says that the contribution of property to a partnership does not constitute a sale or exchange, there was no sale or exchange, and the partnership doesn't terminate under 708B1B either. So if it doesn't terminate under 708B1A, and it doesn't terminate under 708B1B, then it doesn't terminate, even though the business is now being conducted in an entity that has a different employer identification number. Well, folks, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to these weekly opportunities to share the tax news. And as always, stay safe.